Although he tried to fulfill that ministry and service primarily as an exponent and administrator, he also extended himself in a limited ministry. He received the office of 70 when he was 18, but never regarded himself as a successful missionary. First, he never served full-time mission. Second, as a civil servant, he avoided imposing religious discussions on non-Mormons among whom he lived and worked. He was content to allow his Mormon identity and ethical living to accomplish a work of passive proselytizing. He seldom brought up religion, but did not hesitate to answer inquiries from non-Mormon friends about LDS beliefs. When orchestra maestro Leopold Stokowski visited Mexico City in 1931, he asked Ambassador Clark to explain the basis of Mormonism. Stokowski later remarked, "I am not a religious man, I am a musician. Yet the religious ideas he expressed to me by Mr. Clark appealed to me as being eminently good, beautiful, and true," unquote. Never a forceful missionary, Reuben more actively promoted LDS teachings among his non-Mormon friends after he became a general authority. While in Buenos Aires, he performed his first baptism on 5 September 1936 for a brother-in-law of Richard Evans. 15 years later, he noted in his office diary that the man was an active LDS member living in Chicago. Still, Reuben did not consider his first baptism to be a conversion story. He had merely performed the ordinance without having taught the gospel to this person. Reuben's infrequent efforts at proselytizing individuals were nonetheless impressive. Therese Schley, an Episcopalian who was vice president of Chase Manhattan National Bank and director of 14 other major corporations, he wrote in 1941, "I noticed that you said you have no thought of joining the church. On my part, I have no thought that I am converting you. I thank you for the compliment to me personally regarding my mode of life. I am not sure that I agree with you that it is scarcely worthwhile for two busy men to enter into a discussion of theology. I am not sure that if theology be given the field and importance it claims, that there is very much else in the world worth a real discussion between two honest men, however busy they may be." Despite his innocent disclaimer, he then outlined in detail to Schley his LDS gospel and his convictions about it. After entering the first presidency, he occasionally sent unsolicited copies of the Book of Mormon and other LDS publications to associates in the State Department and the business world. During the last decade of his life, he maintained a regular religious dialogue by mail with Cloyd H. Marvin, president of George Washington University. Nevertheless, President Clark was suspicious of overly enthusiastic missionary work, just as he was suspicious of any enthusiasm. In 1943, somebody told him that the canning operations of Salt Lake City's Welfare Square included non-members as a public relations activity to make non-Mormons, quote, "feel good toward us," unquote. He replied, "We are not here to make people feel good. We are here to do our work and preach the gospel," unquote. Aside from his jaundiced view of public relations proselytizing, he also opposed superficial conversions. A non-Mormon friend in Salt Lake City wrote in 1948 that his children wanted him to join the church, that he had attended services with them, had grown fond of the ward's bishop, and had met several times with missionaries, and that he had read, quote, "a good deal," unquote, of the Book of Mormon, but he had not decided whether he should join. Reuben's reply was immediate. "Do not join our church merely to please your son. Do not join unless you have what we call a testimony, which is a burning realization that Joseph Smith was a prophet, that through him the Lord restored the gospel and his priesthood, and that this work was divinely set up and is divinely led. If you were to join on any other basis than this, unhappiness would be your lot, and things probably would arise which result in your separation from the church, which would be unsatisfactory for you and for us," unquote. The man's letter could have been a golden opportunity to urge him to follow his inclinations to join the church. But even the prospect of a ready convert could not quench Reuben's lifelong disdain for emotionalism and quick decisions. 9 years later, he wrote Mission President D. Arthur Haycock, quote, With reference to the chart which you enclosed, I wish to congratulate you upon the tremendous growth you have made in your baptisms." Unquote. He added, "I hope your conversions at least approximate your baptisms." Little side reports that drift to me indicate that is not always the fact in our missions. Unquote. To Reuben, a sharp growth in convert baptisms was cause for scrutiny, not celebration. For that reason, he opposed the accelerated baseball baptisms that his former protege, Henry D. Moyle, promoted worldwide during the last 2 years of Reuben's life. Until he was 76 years old, Reuben was convinced that his own missionary efforts had utterly failed. However, during October 1947 conference, a young married woman from California surprised him by saying that she had converted after reading one of his published explanations of the LDS teachings. He replied that she was his, quote, "first and only convert then," unquote. A few years later, he was, quote, "utterly amazed," as he described it, to learn that a married couple converted after hearing him explain LDS tenets to a gathering of newspaper journalists. His missionary efforts had been so passive most of his life and so selective later that he told a missionary meeting in 1956, quote, "In spite of that kind of missionary labor, President McKay, I may as well unburden the whole thing here, I have had at least three converts to my credit who came in and told me so," unquote. Although he never claimed he had the gift of healing, and in fact was suspicious of anyone claiming that gift, he frequently demonstrated faith in the potential to invoke God's healing through priesthood administrations. In the mid-1920s, a young couple moved into the Salt Lake 20th Ward, where Reuben taught the gospel doctrine class. The young man became ill, and the wife asked Reuben to administer to him. After doing so, he took the woman aside, quote, and told her to get a doctor as soon as she could, and that her husband had a bad case of appendicitis, unquote. Even though the attending physician had no clear diagnosis of the young man's difficulty, the couple went to the hospital for tests, where it was determined that the man did have appendicitis. The doctor who performed the emergency surgery, quote, said he ought to be dead, but he recovered, unquote. On another occasion, President Clark administered to a young woman who had Hodgkin's disease and was pregnant with her first child. Her physicians had told her she could not survive the childbirth. He later commented, quote, "The Lord listened to our prayers on that occasion when I administered to her, and she has not only had a child, but several others. Her family now numbers 9. Again, I say the Lord can do wonders," unquote. Moreover, Apostle Spencer W. Kimball described it as a miracle when Reuben administered to him for his loss of speech, which was restored to him immediately after the blessing. In some instances, he administered for the peaceful release of the dying, not to heal them. On 25 July 1939, he and Heber J. Grant visited Apostle Melvin J. Ballard, who had leukemia and brain hemorrhages. Reuben wrote, quote, "Sister Ballard sent out word that she would like Brother Grant to dedicate him to the Lord. As we walked in, Brother Grant said he could not do it and asked me to officiate," unquote. Grant explained, quote, "I do not think he recognized us. His eyes glazed, and I felt that I just could not utter a prayer dedicating him to the Lord. He is the first man that I nominated to be an apostle, and I asked Brother Clark to comply with the request of the family," unquote. Reuben wrote, quote, "I asked the Lord that if the time had come that he was to pass on, that he be taken in peace and not have to suffer and struggle. I did not dedicate him to the Lord," unquote. President Grant concluded, quote, "I was impressed by his placing a good, strong if in his prayer," unquote. Elder Ballard died 5 days later. 20 years later, President Clark told a general priesthood meeting that in administering to the sick, or when making any request in prayer, everyone should pray, quote, "even as Christ prayed in the garden, saying, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done," unquote. For example, in administering to Apostle Harold B. Lee's father, Reuben, quote, "blessed him to get well, unless his time had come to go," unquote. Samuel M. Lee died 2 days later. Reuben merged rationality with faith as he performed the healing ordinance. Marin G. Romney wrote in his diary, quote, "he gave Ida a blessing. It was an extraordinary blessing, calm, sure, appropriate, comforting. He has a great mind, well-trained, perfect faith, and great strength," unquote. As he spoke with people about priesthood administrations, he absolutely refused to let them think that the healing occurred because he was the one performing the ceremony. Quote, "I want you to understand this," he told the wife of a general authority as he was about to administer to her, quote, "that in and of myself I have no power to heal you, but I have faith that the Lord can do it, and we can ask the Lord to bless you," unquote. A woman came to him for a blessing because he was a member of the First Presidency, even though she had received an administration already from Elder LeGrand Richards of the 12th. Reuben quietly observed, quote, "There is no more spiritual man than Brother Richards," unquote. Clark's frequent counsel to accept the will of the Lord in physical difficulties met a severe test during the polio epidemic of 1952. A member of his own family was stricken with the disease, but he stated to the priesthood session of conference that year in October, quote, "When physicians tell you that nothing can be done, that they know nothing about the disease, I tell you, you fall back awfully fast on the Lord in humility. And having lived reasonably righteously, the Lord will hear us. Then, it being his will and in his wisdom, he gives us the blessings we ask for ourselves and for our loved ones," unquote. Then, in a spontaneous expression of compassion, President Clark told the conference that he had just learned that the son of Tabernacle organist Roy M. Darley had contracted polio. Reuben Perlett prayed, quote, "May the Lord bless and heal his little one," unquote. He later learned that the child had a high fever up until the time of the priesthood meeting, after which the boy's temperature returned to normal. Reuben felt special compassion for Latter-day Saints when death came to their loved ones, despite priesthood administrations, despite promises of patriarchal blessings for long life, and despite the youth and potential of the deceased. He once wrote a two-page, single-spaced, typed letter to a young widow who could not understand the precipitous deaths of her husband and his brother. Quote, "Personally, I'm not sure that the time of our going, certainly if our lives are righteous, is of any particular importance in the great plan, or to the individual, nor is the manner of our going of any importance. It may be by disease, long and lingering, by tragic suffering to the one passing and to his loved ones. It may be by sudden failure of the heart or a blood clot in the brain, or it may be by accident. The method makes little difference. It is my prayer that the Lord will bless you and give you a surcease to worrying and pondering about matters about which the Lord has given us no distinct revelation, and that you may be able to travel forward in faith, relying on the Lord's kindness and mercy and justice," unquote. He was not simply stating platitudes, a practice alien to his very nature, but he was expressing his deepest convictions. He had suffered through the deaths, lingering and precipitous, of his parents, his brothers, sisters, wife, son-in-law, and many other loved ones. Quote, "Why is a good man taken and an evil one left? This is an inscrutable problem," he wrote to Romania Hyde Woolley. He told non-LDS friends that he found comfort in the gospel of Jesus Christ that, quote, "makes things bearable," unquote. Knowing the grief of death in his own experience, he could not take lightly the grief of others. When Apostle George F. Richards grew faint the day after his wife's funeral in 1946, Reuben embraced him. When a young man was killed in a freak accident at the Hotel Utah in 1949, he looked up the young man's membership records so that he could ask the ward bishop to comfort the fellow's parents. To the widow of his LDS associate, William E. Ryberg, he wrote in 1950, "I hope you will allow me to express to you my deepest sympathy for the great loss and resulting sorrow which has come to you. I know the burden you bear and the grief that afflicts you, for I too have endured," unquote. When some young girls were killed by lightning during an outing in Idaho in 1951, he suggested that the general presidency of the Young Women's Organization send flowers and a personal letter of condolence to each of the parents. In June 1952, an automobile struck a little girl in front of the Salt Lake 20th Ward Chapel. where President Clark was attending an evening meeting. Dressed in a white summer suit, he rushed to the scene of the accident and, quote, took that bleeding child into his arms. He became accustomed in giving religious counsel about sickness and death. Oh, this is lighter. But his limited experience in church administration often left him unprepared for other realities. In July 1933, he had his first experience with those people he called, quote, religious cranks, unquote. A man sent him, quote, the word of the Lord, which condemned him for being a man of the world and not of the holy priesthood, unquote, and disfellowshipped him for not resigning from the first presidency. In 1938, a man congratulated him on his conference talk and then asked for, quote, $5,000 to finance a book's publication exposing crime, which is synonymous with sin, unquote. The pathetic instability of such people cropped up in another letter, quote, you wouldn't want to see me in an insane asylum, would you, unquote, the Mormon exclaimed, and then asked Rubin to tell two men to go to hell and concluded with a request for $12,000. Even Mormons who were mentally stable could make bizarre requests. In 1945, a woman telephoned, quote, to ask whether or not it were wise to invest in real estate, unquote. On the same day, a man visited Rubin's office to ask whether to sell a house. During the next several years, LDS men and women pestered him with similar questions about their personal finances. Remarkably, he took the time to counsel with them. Quote, we talked various investments, but I gave no advice, unquote. One woman asked President Clark to help her complete her income tax forms. Another visited the presidency's office in 1949 to learn how to sell and patent, quote, a sanitary toilet seat cover she had invented, unquote. On the same day as this visit, a BYU sophomore asked Rubin if she should transfer to the University of Utah. While he patiently allowed church members to impose on his time with odd requests, he showed little patience for rank-and-file Mormons who tried to give him advice about LDS policy. To one member, whom he labeled a crank, Rubin wrote, quote, I never knew a section hand who did not know better how to run the railroad than the railroad president knew how to run it, unquote. He replied with equal sarcasm when George H. Brimhall, Jr., attempted to instruct him about the operation of old age pensions, which Rubin had publicly condemned. He did not tell these letter writers that prior to becoming a general authority, he himself had mailed unsolicited advice to the LDS president, who likewise disregarded it. Rubin grew to resent such demands on his time. He strongly urged other general authorities to spend less time counseling. To Apostle Kimball, he wrote, quote, I may be all wrong about this, but I do not conceive that trying to straighten out petty difficulties of petty people, not always with all their buttons, as people now say, is a primary duty for the church, unquote. Nevertheless, Rubin hesitated to turn away anyone who came to him for counsel. In 1951, a man went to him for advice about business affairs, quote, President Clark said that he could not come to one of the brethren with the thought that they had revelations for people who want advice. The Lord can do it, and sometimes he does do it, but generally he gives us our free agency to work out our own affairs. And he would be glad to talk to him, but he was a poor man to come to and had no real business experience, unquote. The man still persisted in asking for Reuben's advice. Nor would Rubin indicate impatience over the time consumed by such conversations and interviews. It was not uncommon for him to spend 45 minutes or longer with someone who sought his listening ear. In view of his private feeling against the hierarchy's involvement in such counseling, this was extraordinary. But it was an echo of his pre-hierarchy approach in Mexico. Reserved and yet accessible, the ambassador was ready to talk to anybody. Although he tended to be a legalist, he took a different approach in ministering to Latter-day Saints. This is best indicated by the blessing he gave his brother Samuel when ordaining him a bishop in 1941. Quote, we bless you, dear brother, with the spirit of fatherhood, that you may be able to be a father to all the members of your ward. We bless you that you may be able to put out from your heart every feeling but one of affection and kindness to every man, woman, and child in your ward." Unquote. A decade later, he gave similar advice to Thomas S. Monson. Quote, "Knowing that I was a newly appointed bishop presiding over a difficult ward, President Clark emphasized the need for me to know my people, to understand their circumstances, and to minister to their needs." Unquote. Toward opponents, Reuben could deliver blistering condemnations. To his closest associates in church administration, he could be unnervingly blunt. But in personal counseling, he spoke with restraint, compassion, and the openness of a loving father. To priesthood leaders, he said, quote, "We always like to make a rule and then to fit everything into the rule. And having made one ruling under a given set of circumstances, we try to make the same sort of ruling under every other like set of circumstances. Now, brethren, I don't think you can do that when you are dealing with the spiritual side. And that is the most important side in all the things that we are trying to do." Unquote. Throughout his varied experiences in the secular world, Reuben found both complexity and diversity in people's motives, actions, attitudes, and abilities, weaknesses, and vulnerabilities. As one of the highest leaders of the church, he felt he could not righteously ignore such diversity among those who struggled to be saints. Quote, "I fear that some of us are going to be greatly surprised," he once wrote, "to see in the celestial kingdom a number of people that we would have assigned to a far lesser kingdom." Unquote. Reuben was particularly concerned about the tradition of regarding and categorizing lapsed Mormons as, quote, "inactive" or "apostate." Unquote. Although he used these terms himself, he tried to encourage others to recognize that the words described a condition that might not be permanent. Quote, "Do not go to them and approach them on the basis that they are lost, or on the basis that they are criminal," he warned the bishops in 1948. He told the bishops the following year, "Occasionally you will find in the church the greatest good coming from putting in ward positions men before they have reformed." He quoted the words of an inactive Mormon when asked to be the new bishop of a ward. "Hell, I don't even know how to pray." Reuben answered and added, quote, "But he did. We all know how to pray. This man became a great bishop." Unquote. Some people failed to understand that Reuben was capable of compassion. They saw him only as the statesman, only as the Republican loyalist, only as the vigorous administrator, only as the self-sufficient scholar, only as the legalist and constitutionalist. As Bruce C. Hafen has observed, quote, "For all his tough-mindedness and high standards, J. Reuben Clark's attitudes toward other people were sensitive, humane, and the very opposite of elitist." Unquote. Elder Romney observed, "President Clark was a kind, thoughtful, generous man and a congenial companion. I don't know anyone who was more thoughtful of us who worked under his direction. Whenever one of us was absent because of illness, he daily inquired concerning our welfare. He was ever solicitous about our safety as we traveled." Unquote. Clark's compassion extended to administrative situations involving those far down the chain of command. And I quote a long section here about his wanting to be sure that Joseph S. Puri was not hurt by being asked to, by being released, not being asked to resign, but being released from his position as a Temple Square director of guides. And he had been in that position for years and years. And the final decision was that there would not even be a suggestion of his retiring, because he thought, Reuben thought, it would disturb the peace of mind of Brother Puri. Reuben also wrote letters of encouragement and pleaded for spiritual renewal of other Mormons. He spoke of, quote, "more sorrow than I can express to you," to church members who had discarded their testimonies. Even for apostates, and he used the term, who came to his office with, quote, "blasphemous words and arrogant attitudes," quote, "I tried to talk calmly and kindly, but straightforwardly," unquote. As another example, most inactives did not refrain from using coffee, tea, alcohol, and tobacco, as required by LDS leaders in the 20th century. Reuben urged active Mormons to keep their outward observance in perspective. Quote, "I hope I will not be misunderstood," he told the bishops, "for I am a thorough believer in the word of wisdom. But I should like to say to you that the use of tea and coffee and tobacco is not the worst offense in the world." Unquote. Likewise, with reference to the location of the Word of Wisdom in section 89 of the Doctrine and Covenants, he criticized, quote, "the 89ers, Word of Wisdomers, who made tea, coffee, tobacco, and alcohol more significant than lying, stealing, cheating, hating, backbiting, character ruining, and defaming gossip," unquote. Moreover, he opposed what he regarded as extremist nutritional views. For example, he criticized an unnamed sister, apparently Leah DeWitzel, who had told the wives of the authorities at one of their socials, quote, that they should not eat citrus fruits or drink milk, unquote. In exasperation, Rubin said that if such talk continued, pretty soon we would not be eating anything, unquote. He could also be harsh in his public instructions concerning sexual conduct and immorality, and admit it. This is what you came here for, to hear this. As early as 1941, he told young men and women that it was, quote, "the law of this church," unquote, "to prefer to bury a young Latter-day Saint rather than for the youth to be sexually unchaste." The church's newspaper printed this on its front page. In his published remarks to young women in 1946, he said that he did not trust his own daughters, himself, nor anyone else in matters of sexuality. In his published remarks to General Priesthood Meeting in 1949, he warned, quote, "a wise and pure boy or girl, one who that wishes to be clean, will not pet or neck or nor love play nor any practice or nor practice any other undue physical indiscretions," unquote. He told bishops in 1950, quote, "that it is not healthy for a young man and woman to dance together all evening." As early as 1951, he has published remarks to a general priesthood meeting, apparently alluded to homosexuality, when he criticized men for walking around nude in gymnasiums. By that time, he had asked Gordon Affleck to organize a surveillance for possible homosexuals in the steam rooms of the church-owned Deseret Gymnasium. In 1952, the Relief Society magazine published President Clark's warning to LDS women against, quote, "self-pollution and carnal knowledge with beasts," unquote. He told them that birth defects occur, quote, "because way back beyond the reaches of our memories or our knowledge, some mother or father committed a wrong which passes down," unquote. His daughter Marion Sharp was the magazine's editor. At this 1952 meeting of LDS women, he also warned that, quote, "homosexuals are today exercising great influence in American society." He asked these women, quote, "I wonder if you girls have ever reflected on the thought that was in the mind of the man who first began to praise you for your boyish figures," unquote. In 1954, he specifically warned males at the General Conference against that, quote, "filthy crime of homosexuality," unquote. In 1960, he wrote of a, quote, "serious homo situation at BYU," unquote, which was reflected in surveys over a 20-year period, which showed that 10% of the male students admitted to having homoerotic experience. Despite such explicit references to sexual misconduct, Rubin opposed any form of sex education. He told the General Priesthood Meeting in 1949, quote, "parents are grasping at straws in an effort to hold their children. The cry is raised that the church needs a book on sex. But what should such a book tell? Already the schools have taught sex facts ad nauseum. All their teachings have but torn away at the modesty that once clothed sex. Their discussions tend to make, and sometimes seem to make, sex animals of our boys and girls. The teachings do little but arouse curiosity for experience. It is said that these courses tell enough about the generation of human beings to enable the youth, largely, to escape parenthood. Books are written, courses are given about courtship and marriage. To what point? A word on chastity can be given in one sentence. Two words, be chaste. That tells everything. You do not need to know all the details of the reproductive processes in order to keep clean. Be chaste because God commanded it, for that is all there is to it," unquote. There was one particular philosophy of sex education that he especially condemned in his 1951 address. Quote, "the doctrine that the sex urge is like the urge for food and drink, a teaching that is born of Satan, and the man or woman who teaches it is Satan-inspired," unquote. Mormons responded to President Clark's condemnations. a woman who had committed adultery 27 years before, but who had since that time, quote, done nothing but sorrow and repent for her misdeeds, unquote, sought his counsel. Likewise, a male applicant for church employment, quote, who had committed sexual transgression as a youth, unquote. Reuben spoke so harshly to prevent the chaste from succumbing to temptations, but he also realized that his words might crush the hearts of those who had already committed transgression. In his copy of Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he penned the following marginal notation, quote, because in our weakness we cannot live the lofty moral and spiritual life of the gospel, is no argument that such a life is not desirable, or that it is not the life prescribed by the Master, unquote. His use of the word cannot, rather than choose not to, is significant, because throughout his life he wrote private notations with legalistic precision. In this case, he seemed to be saying that there are some humans who do not have the ability to reach the lofty standards of the church. Despite the obligation he felt to condemn sin in the strongest possible terms, he preached the entreaty, quote, all you repentant transgressors, come, partake of the God of God's all-wise justice and of his boundless infinite mercy and love. To the transgressor yet unrepentant the Lord calls, unquote. Reuben raised a strident voice against sin of all kinds, yet spoke healing words in private to transgressors. Concerning a teacher at a church school who had engaged in homosexual intimacy for several years, the man's stake president, quote, inquired about whether he should be handled churchwise, in other words, through disfellowshipment or excommunication. And I said that thus far we had done no more than drop them from positions they held in the church, unquote. Visited by a woman who had committed adultery 20 years before, but had, quote, lived a good, clean life since that time, he said, quote, where transgression has been in secret, the essential thing is repentance, unquote. To former Apostle Richard R. Lyman, who was publicly excommunicated for violating church rules of sexual conduct, President Clark wrote, quote, with reference to the other matter to which you refer, it is consoling to know that however much we who are here may err in our judgment and decisions, nevertheless the Lord knows all, and in the hereafter he will see that all wrongs are righted and all proper restorations accomplished. My own formula with reference to these matters I have often expressed as follows. I believe that the Lord will bestow upon us all the rewards that is possible for him to bestow, having in mind the connection with his infinite mercy and love and charity, the absolute demands of justice. On the other hand, I think he would impose the least penalty for the errors and misdoings that is possible to impose, having in mind his love, charity, and forgiveness that the demands of justice absolutely require. These words had special significance because, as Lyman assumed, Reuben had made the decisions to investigate and discipline him. A few years later, however, Reuben was simply baffled to learn of the situation in an LDS ward not far from Salt Lake City. Quote, it appears that the bishop has been making love to the wife of one of his counselors, that one of his counselors had been making love to the wife of the other counselor, but that the counselor not involved in these two observations has been making love to some third party. None of the men were straight in the situation, and the only woman who was straight was the wife of the bishop, who has 5 children and is about to have another, unquote. He did not have a ready answer when the stake president asked what he should do. Ignoring the situation seemed impossible, yet excommunicating the ward's entire bishopric and 2 of their wives would have had a devastating effect on the local members. Quote, I told President P. that they would have to decide what they wanted to do down there, and that they would have to keep in mind the effect which the situation would have on the young people of the ward, that was the prime consideration, unquote. In matters of legal justice, Reuben could also urge the broadest leniency. He once petitioned the chief of the Los Angeles Probation Department to grant probation to a Latter-day Saint convicted of perjury. Even though the man had taken, quote, no active part in church work, he has always been a man of profound religious convictions and had been a devoted and loving father and husband, unquote. Concerning suicide, President Clark said that, quote, the ideal was to be as comforting to the family as possible, which in cases of suicide had double grief, unquote. He authorized LDS funerals for suicides, including burial in temple clothes, quote, on the theory that no person in his right mind would commit suicide, and that he, since he was not in his right mind, there was no crime involved, unquote. He kept in mind the legal dimensions of justice, but always reminded himself and others not to lose sight of the human dimensions of compassion. He sometimes commented publicly on the relationships between the male-only priesthood of the church and its women's auxiliary, the Relief Society. He instructed local bishops in 1947, quote, I want to say a word about the Relief Society. Most of you, brethren, I'm sure, are married. And if your homes are happy ones, as I assume they are, you know that your wives expect some kind of consideration. If she has earned a little money, she would not relish the idea of your going into her purse and taking her money and using it for some expense of your own. It will not work, as probably some of us have found. Now, the Relief Society president and the Relief Society members are the mothers of the war. I have heard of cases where the Relief Society had considerable money, a lot of money for the Relief Society. I heard in one case where the Relief Society of the ward had $1,000. And when the bishop started to build a meeting house, he went and took the $1,000. Now, the meeting house is your business, bishops, and I suggest you try to get the money some other way than by appropriating it. I could call it by some other names than by appropriating the Relief Society funds. My home has been a Relief Society home all my life, and I know something of the work that is entailed and done by the Relief Society in trying to get a little money. Now, they ought to help you, and they will help, and I am amazed the way the Relief Society has hearkened to the brethren of the priesthood. If we thought as much of the priesthood as most of our sisters do, it would be a better world. Let us not impose on them, unquote. President Clark took frequent opportunities to give counsel about marriage. To an anxious mother of a young girl who wanted to marry a non-Mormon, he reminisced about his own worries about his daughters marrying a non-Mormon. He added, quote, quite obviously, measures of force are out of the question, even if they were wise, and usually they are not. If you could get her to put off her marriage for a period and then get her back into active church work, it might be a make your problem easier. When an LDS woman asked if she would be guilty of sin by marrying outside the church, he replied, quote, there is no sin in honorable marriage, unquote. I'm going to skip down a number of issues. He talks about incest, and I'm going to skip that. He talks about equality in marriage, and I'm going to skip that. Goes on for a while. He publicly proclaimed that motherhood is the highest type of service which we mortals know, and expressed disapproval of efforts to restrict birth. Nevertheless, he recognized that special circumstances might require modification of this general recommendation. To a woman who favored government programs concerning birth control, quote, I told her that as far as I knew, the church had never officially taken a position on the question of birth control, though all of our teachings were against it. I stated that if we had a belief in the free agency of man, and that that belief forbade us to attempt to coerce people. I stated that this view in concerning the question of birth control was left for determination of each individual man and wife, who would, however, if the matter came up, be reminded of the principles of the church that govern such matters. When a woman asked if she should be sterilized after two of her physicians recommended it, President Clark said that he would advise her, quote, as if she were my own wife or my own daughter, unquote. If she had the opinion of two of the best physicians available to her, and if she herself felt that their recommendations to be sterilized was in her best interest, quote, then I would tell the wife or the daughter that she should do as the doctors advised. He approached this pragmatic approach, or he applied this pragmatic approach to abortion, even though he and the first presidency shared a general abhorrence of it. He recognized that there were circumstances where abortion might be necessary due to the emotional physical health of the pregnant woman or the medical condition of the unborn fetus. For example, a woman sought his counsel on behalf of herself and several other pregnant women who had contracted German measles. Concerning this inquiry, quote, I told her that she should ask the advice of her physician concerning an abortion, getting as such advice and counsel as she can, and also seek the Lord in prayer. She said that in such cases, the hearing of the child may be affected, or the child may even be mongoloid, in other words, Down syndrome. I suggested that she might go wish to get the advice of two or three doctors in the matter. In his view, it was a private decision to be made between the individuals involved and the Lord. He talks about fatherhood, and I'm going to conclude at this point. Nevertheless, as previously quoted, Reuben recognized that good people might not believe in Mormonism, nor attend LDS services, nor live the word of wisdom, nor marry in a temple, nor always live the church's precepts of ethics and morality. He also recognized that even such righteous fathers as Adam, Noah, and Jacob in the Bible, and Lehi in the Book of Mormon, had children who were wayward or left the faith. This also occurred among children of modern apostles and prophets. He specifically countered the criticism of some people, that children of LDS leaders strayed because their parents were preoccupied with church service. He repeated an anecdote of J. Golden Kimball. Quote, Brother Kimball said, well, he spent a good deal of time preaching the gospel and doing the Lord's work, and if his family went astray, he was sorry. But he said, I get some consolation out of the fact that when I go around and see the people in the church, I think the Lord has not done too good a job himself, unquote. After the laughter died down from this story, Reuben spoke with utmost seriousness to the local bishops. Do what you can to save the young people in your own homes, unquote. Indeed, despite his preoccupation with church administration, President Clark was deeply concerned about the spiritual welfare and present happiness of the Latter-day Saints. Even his attention to procedures and programs was a manifestation of his interest in the children, youth, husbands, wives, widows, poor, infirm, and elderly of Zion. He conducted his personal ministry to them in his own way and according to his own talents. The service was a product of his lifelong sense of identity with the Latter-day Saints and his feeling of responsibility toward them. Thank you. We have a few minutes, and we'll still be on time for the rest of the sessions you may want to attend. Yes? For most white Americans, their awareness of the civil rights movement is in the 60s, and J. Reuben Clark died in 1961. However, his statements about the early stage of the civil rights movement were always negative. Because the civil rights movement sought to end segregation and sought to bring about integration, and the emphasis was on African Americans and people who were not black in color, in terms of the color definitions of the time. And Reuben opposed those efforts, and he stated so in very clear terms in a number of ways. He was, until he died, the executive vice president of the Hotel Utah, and the Hotel Utah, till he died in 1961, would allow African Americans to be servants within the Hotel Utah, but excluded them from dining there and excluded them from being guests there. He also adamantly defended the LDS hospitals policy of segregating the blood donated by whites from the blood donated from people of color. Although not all people of color, just African Americans. If it was donated by Chicano, then then it would be considered white blood. So he adopted the race definitions of the American South and defended Jim Crow as it existed not only in the American South but in Utah. Jim Crow had migrated north and under the leadership of the Mormon Church. So his only specific reference to the civil rights movement, aside from these references to breaking down the color line, and that was his term, was in Little Rock, Arkansas. And he made specific reference to the protests in Little Rock, Arkansas over segregation when he gave instruction to the member of the Relief Society in attending a meeting of the National Council of Women that she should do everything that she could to prevent them from endorsing civil rights. So even though the movement, as most white Americans envision it, was really not a 60s movement, when he had the opportunity to comment on it before that time, his comments were always negative. However, it's more complex than that. And in the book I have recently published, I point that out. By his own lights, he was consistent. But as you read the written word, it sounds inconsistent. And when the Supreme Court in 1954 announced Brown versus Board of Education, he prepared a talk. Usually he didn't prepare talks in advance. He spoke extemporaneously from notes. But he prepared a talk that the full text of which was written in advance, that he wanted to give to the October 1954 General Conference, in which he applied the Brown versus Board of Education to the position of the church and wanted to express the church's support for full civil rights for African Americans, which is extraordinary in terms of everything else he was doing. So he was not a person you can easily pigeonhole.
When I was in the mission home, a waiter who was a black man stood up and he said that one day J. Ruth Clark had talked to him for like 12 hours and got baptized the next day. So it's interesting, but I do have to...
That was Monroe Fleming.
Oh, that.
And that's actually the only African American that I have record of J. Reuben Clark referring to specifically by name.
Okay, so I got two questions. So I don't know if you have time to talk about the McKay men versus the Clark men. That's sort of interesting. Did you imply that his daughter married out of the church, or?
No, he was afraid that his daughters would, but I'd like to leave the questions on the area that we've presented today rather than that McKay man. Clark has a very interesting issue, but I think we better defer that. Question toward the back. Somebody? Nope? All right, yes.
Do you have any idea what the publication was that caused the league in California?
Oh, I missed that.
He had said that there's a league in California that attributed her conversion to some publication of President Clark, and I just wondered.
She didn't identify, or at least she may have identified when she spoke with him, but in the office diary that where her visit was recorded, it didn't not identify the publication specifically, so I don't know the answer to that question. Yes?
I guess I'm naive, maybe others are too, but what mechanism kept him from presenting that October 54 conference to us?
The question is, since he had this intent and had the full text written out of giving this talk in October 1954, why didn't he give it? And there is not an explicit statement notated on the text or any other place else to explain why, but I think the evidence is pretty clear that it was David O. McKay who would not allow him to do it because David O. McKay was adamantly in favor of segregation and was adamantly opposed to any change in the race segregation. And in fact, David O. McKay regarded Jim Crow South as an ideal which should be adopted across the United States, which is not the image that most people have of David O. McKay, but that was the evidence in private notations. And that's why, in my view of the evidence, why Rubin did not give this talk. I think it can only be explained because David O. McKay told him not to. Yes, at the back.
Eleanor Roosevelt was a contemporary of his. She would have been on the polar opposite of the political spectrum and on civil rights. She was way, way out there ahead of the rest of white America. Did you find Did he have any juicy things to say about Eleanor Roosevelt?
I don't remember. Of course, it's been 20 years. I don't remember him referring to Eleanor Roosevelt, but he referred a lot to Franklin D. And I make a reference to that a lot of times in the biography. But again, this is a question that moves beyond the presentation today. Yes?
It sticks in my memory that in the April conference, he warned us that our government had committed, by our own definition, acts of war, and to not be surprised when there was retaliation. And of course, in December came Pearl Harbor. I haven't been able to see that documented or mentioned elsewhere.
The question is about J. Reuben Clark's statement to conference that the United States had committed acts of war against Nazi Germany, even though there was no declaration of war, and what is the situation there. I do discuss that, and I do document it in the book, but again, that's beyond the topic that we're dealing with. Yes?
It's a summary question for you.
Okay.
He didn't do this because he was uncomfortable ministering, or because he was inexperienced ministering, or because he got a talent?
Didn't do what?
In terms of being a minister, in terms of actually working with people, the kind of things that you're illustrating, he obviously felt uncomfortable doing it, or he felt he didn't have a talent for it.
Well, the question is, did J. Reuben Clark feel uncomfortable in doing the kind of things I described in this paper of personal ministry? And it's aside from the healing situations where he, even as a prior to his call as a member of the first presidency, he was asked on a few occasions to perform ordinances for healing. Most of these demands on him occurred after he entered the first presidency. And I don't get into the details, I just summarized it in a sentence, but J. Reuben Clark had not only had no presiding experience in, and when I say that, he had not had any position of presiding in a branch, in a ward, in a mission, anywhere. He had been the closest thing you could define as presiding was he had served on a board for the young men's program, a general board. But aside from that, he had been inactive, totally inactive, basically for 20 years in the LDS Church, and that also removed him from a lot of opportunities for personal ministry that he might have had that were thrust upon him because of his being a member of the first presidency. So he preferred to deal with high-level administration. He preferred to be the spokesman, but he could not in good conscience turn down people who came to him. And it's very difficult for us to conceive of the church that he was the second highest leader of, because it was so small. It was so small. And the first presidency's office had a open door policy that anyone could walk off the street, knock on the door of the first presidency's office, and basically be ushered in, like I say, for sometimes a 45-minute conversation with Reuben Clark, the president of the church, who called him to be president, sometimes spent an hour and a half with walk-ins. This was a different kind of church. And so because of the position he was in, he frequently had requests coming to him that he did not feel he could turn down. And even some of those in correspondence, which he could have ignored, he felt that it was a part of the responsibility he had accepted to respond to them in some way. You don't understand J. Reuben Clark if you don't understand his sense of loyalty and his sense of responsibility for any position that he had accepted. And so this was to him just part of the position that he had accepted. But it was not something that he would have sought on his own by any means. And I think we're going to have to close on that. Otherwise, we're going to delay people coming into this room for the next session. Thank you.
Thank you.